I think if we take Parshiot, Shmot, Ve'era, Bo, and Veshalach as a unit, we can identify certain patterns and running themes throughout them and really build a very, very cool yesod as it pertains to the Korban Pesach. And I want to start from an unconventional place, and it is the least understood, seemingly most out of context, most ambiguous story that happens in Parshat Shmot, right? We start with Moshe Rabbeinu walking with his wife Tzipora and his two children, Gershom and Eliezer, back to Mitzrayim. And then they stop at a hotel. And from there, the story gets very, very unclear. I want to read it inside. Vayehi vaderech b'malon, v'yifgashehu Hashem v'yivakesh amito. So they're on their way to a hotel, which is interesting. It doesn't say they're on their way to Egypt and they stop at a hotel. They're on their way to the hotel. It seems like that was their intention all along. And they stop there and God meets them and he requests to kill him. Now, it doesn't say who the him is. We don't know who God is apparently requesting to kill. Now, we want to assume, oh, this is Moshe, and that is what Rashi points out. But it doesn't say Moshe in the previous pasuk. I don't even think it says Moshe in the previous few psukim. And so it's not so clear that we're referring to Moshe here. And I think, just as a general yesod, when learning Chumash, whenever the Torah very easily could have said the name of the person that we're referring to and doesn't, the ambiguity is intentional. Like, maybe I'm supposed to be able to understand that this may have been multiple people here. Now, in practice, it was one and not the other, but there's a reason the Torah is writing it ambiguous. It wants to leave room to understand that a few things could be going on here. So, God requests to kill him. We don't know who that is. Vatikach Tzipora Tzor. And then Tzipora takes a rock. Right? That we have the name. We know that this is Tzipora doing it. Vatichrot et Orlat Bina. And she cuts off the orla of her son. Tzipora has two sons. Again, this is ambiguous. Why don't you tell me which son we're talking about? Now, we assume, and Rashi assumes, that this is talking about Eliezer. He was born second, and very recently, he doesn't have a Brit Mila yet. It makes sense that we're talking about Eliezer. But then again, say Eliezer. We know who Eliezer is. We know who Gershom is. The fact that you're leaving the names out of this, except for Tzipora, is very odd. And furthermore, why would it be Tzipora? Why is Tzipora doing this and not Moshe? Well, that question is probably what leads Rashi to say that Moshe is the one being killed, and while he's being killed, he can't go ahead and do the Brit Mila for her son. And then something interesting happens. Vataga l'raglav. Right? So she takes the blood and she touches the blood to her son's legs. That's odd as well because that's not a custom in doing a Brit Mila. Right? Where does that come from? Vatomer. And she says, ki chatan damim atali. You're a chatan damim. Meaning your blood is a symbol for me. Still, we think we're talking about a Brit Mila. Vayiref mimenu az amra chatan damim lamalut. Right? And then he released him. Who is the he? Or it would have been God, or that messenger God sent to be killing someone. So whoever was killing someone released the one that he was killing. And then afterwards, Tzipora says, oh, this blood sign that I had made, that should actually be the circumcision of my child. Which makes it sound like the circumcision was the afterthought and not the original intention, which is very curious, right? Meaning, we were taught that she was doing a Brit Mila. We were taught that the problem was her child didn't have a Brit Mila. She was fixing that problem. We were taught that Moshe was incapacitated and therefore couldn't fix the problem, and Moshe was being killed because he delayed in giving his son a Brit Mila. But it doesn't even seem like she's giving a Brit Mila to her son. It seems like she wants to make some kind of blood sign, and whatever blood sign that was, it was enough to spare whoever was being killed. And then the Brit Mila only comes in later, once whoever was being killed was already spared. Like, A, that wasn't the point of this. That wasn't her intention. Zipporah's intention was not to give a Brit Mila to her son. It was an afterthought, a convenience. And second of all, whatever was wrong, that needed to be corrected by the circumcision of her son, was corrected before she ever had the intention of doing the circumcision. It was corrected in order to... It was corrected by this chatan damim, whatever that means. So the story is odd, it's strange, it seems out of place, it's ambiguous, we don't really know what's going on or with whom. Now let's look at what happens immediately before the story and immediately after the story, and I think we're even more confused. So Moshe proceeds on his way. That's what we know. Hey, where's Tzipora? Where's Eliezer? Where's Gershom? We actually don't know what happens with them next, right? Maybe the journey was too difficult. Maybe it's not the, you know, the appropriate journey for them. They should stay back in Midian. Moshe's going to meet up with them later, as we see eventually in Parshat Yitro. But without saying a word, they're no longer with Moshe. What happens immediately before this? That might be the oddest thing of all. Kadosh Baruch Hu is speaking with Moshe, and he says, Moshe, you're going to come to Paro. Okay, we get it. We've heard this story before. Moshe's going to go to Paro, and he's going to speak, and he's going to warn them, you have to let my people go, and if not, I'm going to bring 10 plagues, or look at this sign, Kadosh Baruch Hu is with us. No, that's not what God says here. It's what he says elsewhere. Here he says, Moshe, you're going to go to Paro, and you're going to tell him that I am going to bring a terrible, terrible plague. It's called the Makat Pechorot. It is going to strike down and kill all the firstborns in Egypt if you don't let the Jews go. And what's interesting is that's the 10th plague. Right? Well, how did we even get here? Moshe hasn't even come to Paro to give him the signs yet, much less Dam or Tzvardea or Kinim. And Kadosh Baruch Hu is giving Moshe seemingly a commandment to go before Paro and speak about Makat Pechorot. That's not now. That is way later in the future. What does it have anything to do with what we're talking about right now? Why are we skipping 9 plagues? Why are we skipping signs and going straight to Makat Pechorot? I want to suggest that what's happening here is as follows. Everything makes perfect sense in context. We just need to fill in a couple details. We'll borrow a couple midrashim perhaps to help us with those details. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking to Moshe about Makat Bechorot. Not because he's giving Moshe a commandment to go tell this to Paro right now at this moment. But he is telling Moshe what he eventually will be saying to Paro. Why does right now, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu need to tell Moshe right now what Moshe will eventually be telling to Paro? Because it's relevant right now. Because Moshe Rabbeinu has decided that Tzipora, Eliezer, and Gershom should not come along with them. And that is why they're going to a hotel, they're going to stop at an inn, or whatever the Malone refers to, along the way. And at that point, Moshe will be proceeding on his own, but the journey is too difficult for his wife and children. On their way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him as follows. Says it, you know, it may be a wise choice leaving Tzipora, Gershom, and Eliezer behind, but there's just one small issue. See, we're going to reach this plague, and it's going to be called Makat Bechorot. And this plague is going to be designated really for everyone in Egypt, and not just the Mitzrim. And on that night, I'm going to give Klal Yisrael the option of choosing me. Up until now, it is clear that I have chosen them. But they are going to need to make a sign that distinguishes them from everyone else. It is a sign of faith. That says, we are with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not just He chose us, but we chose Him, and we're ready to put our lives on the line for it. And there's one issue with sending Tzipora, Gershom, and Eliezer home, and that is, they're not going to be a part of this. And if they're not a part of this, then they're not a part of Klal Yisrael. Because every single person needs to be a part of this blood sign. You put the blood on the door, that is how you chose me. If not, you are not leaving Mitzrayim. Those are the facts. There's no other way around it. So if Tzipora wants to be a part of Klal Yisrael, she needs to be a part of this. Now we understand why Tzipora is the active participant here. Moshe is going to be in Mitzrayim. So now let's walk through the sequence of events, and I think we'll understand it much better. They're on the way to the Malon. And God wants to kill someone. Who does he want to kill? Well, what was he just talking about? He was just talking about the death of the firstborns. And not just the Egyptian firstborns, the death of all firstborns. So isn't it convenient that there is a midrash that says that the circumcision or that, sorry, that the circumcision, yes, that was given by Tzipporah to her son was not Eliezer, their second son. Rather, it was Gershom, their first son. And you're going to ask, well, wasn't Gershom a little bit older at the time? Isn't that odd? Yes, but Moshe made a pact with Yitro that Moshe was going to marry Yitro's daughter, Tzipporah, but that his first child would be a child committed to Avodah Zarah, and then any subsequent child could be committed to Hashem, the God of the Hebrew people. That's very interesting. What that means is that it's not Eliezer who is being circumcised here. Perhaps it's Gershom who's being circumcised here. And what is the significance of it being Gershom? He's the oldest. And so what if we wanted to say as follows? HaKadosh Baruch Hu was just talking about how he's going to kill all the firstborn sons. And then what does he do in the very next pasuk? He starts killing Moshe's firstborn son. And then Tzipporah takes a rock. Why Tzipporah? Because she needs to do this. Because she is not going to be in Egypt. And she cuts the foreskin of her son. And then what does she do with it? She spreads it on the legs of her son to be a sign. Vatiga l'raglav sounds a lot like vayiga l'mashkof, what Klal Yisrael had to do on the doorposts of their houses in Egypt. And then she says, this is my blood sign. This is my blood sign. I'm not going to be in Egypt. I can't make a blood sign by Makot Bechorot. So this is my blood sign. And then her son, her firstborn son, Gershom, stops dying. The angel, the Malach HaMavet, who was sent to kill her firstborn son, he stops it. Why? Because Tzipporah made the blood sign. And therefore, her firstborn son doesn't die anymore. And therefore, she chose HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and she chose to be a part of Klal Yisrael. And then Tzipporah says, by the way, a little bit of an afterthought, when I cut off the foreskin of my child, that's going to be Limalut. That's going to actually be his circumcision, what he has yet to have up until this point. And then immediately after, we see Moshe proceeding on without them. Why? Because that was the plan all along, and that was the purpose of this whole event. They're not coming with Moshe. They're going to be left out of Yitziat Mitzrayim. They're going to be left out of Kriyat Yamsuf, perhaps left out of Matan Torah. They're going to be left out. What makes them part of Klal Yisrael? The fact that Tzipporah did this at this time, that she chose a Kadosh Baruch Hu, she bought into the program before anything else happened, before any of the Nisim, before any of the Makot happened, she was a part of it and ready to rejoin Moshe when he came out of Mitzrayim. I want to fast forward to examining a little bit more about this, about the Korban Pesach. Right, the sacrifice that we brought on the last night that we were in Egypt, and that we continue to bring every year since then, because it's a very odd korban. What I mean by that is there are things that exist by the Korban Pesach, factors, laws that exist by the Korban Pesach that exist by no other korban. And maybe if it were one or two, you would say, okay, so it's a special korban. But almost everything that has to do with the Korban Pesach does not exist by any other korban. There are so many details. I think I counted 12 or 13 details that we see by Korban Pesach that we don't see by any other korban. And it begs the question, what makes this korban so unique? So let's just go over the details. First of all, everyone has to be eating from it. Everyone needs to be a part of this, right? It's not like a normal korban that you bring on a regel, right? Everyone, every member of Klal Yisrael needs to be eating from it. And not only that, but you need to pre-subscribe to it. Einu ne'echal ela l'minuyav, right? You need to have bought in, meaning you can't come up the night of Pesach and say, oh, I wasn't a part of a Korban Pesach, but you seem to have a lot of leftover, a lot of extra. Can I partake in your Korban? You have to say no. Well, that seems rude. That seems mean. You have plenty. You have entire sheep here. Why don't you just share some? Because you have to have bought in earlier that day. It doesn't work like that. You can't come in the middle of the night and decide that you want to be a part of someone's Korban Pesach. From before it was slaughtered, you needed to know which Korban you were eating from. Right? Furthermore, non-Jews can't eat from it. Here's an interesting halacha that we were told the night, that last night in Egypt. You're not allowed to bring the meat of the Korban outside of your house, which is kind of strange. Meaning you can't, you know, cook it and then go bring some to your friends, obviously, because they're not participating in it. But not even if you want to like show them, you think, oh, I had the perfect, you know, the perfect char on this korban, right? The perfect tinge in the middle. Can't really say it has the pink tinge in the middle because I think it had to be completely well done, unfortunately. But you want to show your friends, look at this wonderful job that I did roasting my korban Pesach. You can't. The meat can't leave your house. Furthermore, you have to eat it b'chipazon. You have to eat it like quickly, like ready to spring into action. Why would that be the case? Meaning, I understand, okay, you have to eat an entire sheep and you can't leave any over. So maybe it's just a byproduct of that fact that you have to eat it b'chipazon. In which case, well, you wouldn't have need to tell me. That's first of all, because I would be eating it that quickly anyway. But furthermore, meaning who says you have to eat it quickly at all? If you have 50 people over, 40 people over for your Korban Pesach, and everyone gets about a steak, what, 30 minutes maybe you eat it? You want to really take your time here? You know, 40 minutes? Take your time. You have hours to eat this. No, eat it quickly. But God, I have all night. Yep, still, eat it quickly. Just eat it as fast as you can. And then just sit here and do nothing? Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking you to do. It's interesting. Furthermore, we only have one night to eat it. Balayla. We can only eat it at night, which is interesting. All other korbanot, we have more time to eat it. And you're supposed to eat it ar chatzot. Definitely the case for the Jews in Mitzrayim, and perhaps, depending on whether you pass, like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah or Rabbi Akiva, perhaps the case for future generations, they can only eat it until chatzot. And furthermore, you're not allowed to leave any over until the morning, lo totiru menu ad boker, but if you did leave any over in the morning, you have to burn it. There are some interesting halacha that also pertain to the way that you need to cook it. First of all, you have to be very careful. Etzem lo tishbaru bo. You're not allowed to break any of the bones when you're eating it. You have to be very careful to keep it intact. And furthermore, there's a specific way that it needs to be cooked. It needs to be cooked tzli esh. What's tzli esh? Don't we know that roasting is over a fire? Yeah, but tzli esh is to indicate to you that it's really one step beyond. You need to have direct contact between the korban itself and the fire. Meaning, if you wanted to roast it in a pan, that doesn't work. You can't put it on a pan or on a tray and then over the open fire. You need direct contact between the korban, the animal itself, and the fire that it's being roasted on. And lo mevushal b'mayim. It can't be cooked as in boiled in water. You can't cook it that way. Well, if I have to do tzli esh, if I have to cook it roasted over an open fire, don't I know that I can't cook it in boiling hot water? Why would you need to tell me both that it needs to be tzli esh and that it can't be cooked in boiling water? Furthermore, rosho al kirav v'al kirbo, it needs to be cooked in its entirety and not in piecemeal. You can't slaughter the animal and then cut it up and cook the legs like this and the torso like this and the arms like this. No, it actually needs to be in its entirety, whole, one piece, while you're cooking it. Those are the 12 interesting details that I wanted to point out about the Korban Pesach that we really don't see by other korbanot. And I think we need to ask why this is so unique. So to answer that question, I want to remind ourselves of some of the major events that happened in Yetziat Mitzrayim, and we're going to see a shocking parallel. First of all, Yetziat Mitzrayim, what did you have to do to leave? In order to not die that night, you had to be, as we said earlier, a part of a korban. You needed to take a korban into your home, take a sheep into your home 4 days before you slaughter it, let it sit there, let everyone see, and then slaughter it and put the blood on your doorpost. And you had to be pre-subscribed. So not only did everyone have to be a part of this if they wanted to leave, but they had to be pre-subscribed to the korban. Meaning, if it became nightfall and you started to worry, hey, you know what, maybe there is something to this whole Yetziat Mitzrayim thing. Maybe I do have what to be worried about here. Maybe a Kadosh Baruch Hu is coming, or the Mashchit is coming, he's going to kill all the firstborns. I really should be a part of this Korban Pesach thing. I'm going to go knock on my neighbor's door and say, hey, can I be a part of your Korban Pesach? And, you know, he loves me and he's going to say, yes, sure. He can't say that because you had to be a part of this from beforehand. You can't wake up in the middle of the night and want to save yourself. You had to be a part of this sheep from the very beginning. Right? You had to, from the time they took it into their homes, you had to know this was the sheep that you were eating, pre-subscribed. Furthermore, you had to have a Brit Milah to be a part of this. Right? And furthermore, that night, Moshe says, you're not allowed to leave your house. That's odd. Right? Meaning, the Korban Pesach, you're not allowed to take the meat out of your house. And the Jews, when they left Egypt, were not allowed to leave their house. They had to stay inside. The meat of the Korban Pesach can't be taken outside, and the Jews can't leave their homes. Furthermore, we left Egypt, we know, b'chipazon. We left Egypt quickly, in a hurry, in a rush. So it's interesting. We have to eat the Korban Pesach in a rush, even if you have all night to eat it. Even if you have all the time in the world, much more time than you need to, no, you need to eat in a rush. And also, the Korban we left Egypt in a rush. We didn't need to eat it in a rush because we left Egypt in a rush, because we had plenty of time to eat it. We just needed to eat it in a rush, and we left in a rush. Furthermore, something I didn't point out about another unique quality, let's call it quality number 13, is that you have to eat it with matzah. You have to eat the Korban Pesach with matzah. And when we left Egypt, we only ate matzah. And maybe you're thinking that we only ate matzah because we didn't have time to bake full breads. But we were told about Korban Pesach 4 days in advance. 5 days, really, by the time the night came around. So we definitely could have had bread for that night. Maybe we wouldn't have time between that night and leaving Egypt to have fresh bread. But we definitely could have had fresh bread for the night. We definitely could have had fresh bread to eat the Korban Pesach with, but no, you have to eat it in with matzah, even though I'm giving you 5 days to prepare. Still, you need to eat it like matzah, as if you had no time at all. So we ate matzah when we left Egypt because we didn't have time, and we ate matzah with the Korban Pesach, even though we had all the time in the world. When did this makkah happen? When? There's a explicit timeline that we're given when it comes to Makkah Bechorot with exceptional detail. First of all, the Makkah happened at night. Balayla. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm coming out Balayla, at night. Furthermore, not just any time, I'm coming out at exactly Chatzot. Right? And furthermore, this one is a little bit creative. I understand if you don't like this one. It's a little bit creative, but I think with everything else kind of coming together, I think it's hard to ignore the symbolism, right? When did we end up leaving Mitzrayim? Be'etzem hayom hazeh. So we said that you can't leave the meat, you can't bring the meat out of your house, and Klal Yisrael couldn't leave that night. You had to eat it quickly, and Klal Yisrael left Mitzrayim quickly. You have to eat it with matzah, and Klal Yisrael left with matzah instead of bread. The makkah happened balayla, and when can you eat the korban? Only balayla. And the makkah happened exactly at chatzot, and when do they have to eat the korban? Ad chatzot. Right? And when did we leave Egypt? Be'etzem hayom hazeh. Perhaps that's reminiscent of etzem lo tishberu bo. You can't break a bone. It's a comparison between the two words, etzem, etzem. And you're not allowed to leave any over in the morning, lo totir menu ad boker. We were not allowed to stay in Mitzrayim in the morning. And hanotar menu ad boker ba'esh tisrafu. Anyone who does leave over to the morning, they're being burnt in the fire. Meaning, it's the last that we're going to hear from them. Ad kan, I think we have a very strong parallel between the events that took place, that the Jews experienced their last night in Egypt, and every single detail that governs the Korban Pesach. But here's where we're going to need to start thinking outside the box, because we have a couple details that we didn't speak about. First of all, it needs to be Tzli Esh. If you want to fast forward, now we're getting to this week's Parsha, Bishalach. You'll notice something very interesting. When do we cross through the Yam Suf? Well, we pass through at night, all night, right? And then by the time we finish, it's morning, and then the Egyptians go in afterward, and the water closes on them. But there are some details that you may not have paid attention to when it comes to how exactly these things took place. First of all, what do we know about the nighttime and the Jewish people traveling? We were protected when we traveled at night. We were protected by an Amud Ha'esh. So right now, if you were to envision this in your head, what are you seeing? You're seeing a Jewish people pass through the Yam Suf, right, the final kind of stage of their exodus, where they're finally breaking free from the Egyptians who are chasing after them, and they are completely surrounded by fire on all sides, protected by the Amud HaEsh, protected by fire. And then we make it through all throughout the night. Then what happens? Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends the Amud HaNan that was defending us between the Egyptians and the Amud HaEsh that was leading the way, and he sends them at the Egyptians. As it says explicitly, Vayehi b'ashmarat ha-boker v'yashkef Hashem el machane Mitzrayim b'amud esh v'anan v'yaham et machane Mitzrayim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu attacks them with the cloud and with the fire. What's happening here? So we need Rashi to understand a little bit about what's really going on here. Be'amud esh ve'anan. Rashi says, Amud anan yored ve'oseh oto ketit. Right? So Amud anan goes down and it makes the ground into clay. Ve'amud esh marticho. And the pillar of fire starts to boil it. And then the horseshoes of the horses of the Egyptians start melting off. And then the wheels of the wagon start melting in this boiling clay that the Egyptians are running through. And then what happens? Then Moshe reaches out his staff and the Yam Suf closes upon the Egyptians. So we have this boiling clay underneath them, and then the Yam Suf closes on the Egyptians and the fire starts to boil the water. And if you look, you see some very interesting terminology used for how HaKadosh Baruch Hu ends up killing them. It doesn't even sound like he drowns them. It says as follows, V'yina'er Hashem et Mitzrayim betoch hayam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu mixes up the Mitzrim in the Yam Suf. And Rashi's words here are going to blow your mind. He says as follows, V'yina'er Hashem, Hashem mixed up, Ke'adam sheminaer et ha-kitera, ve'ofech ha-elyon limata ve'atachton limala. What is the Kadosh Baruch Hu doing to the Mitzrim? It's kind of similar to how a person would mix up their pot when they're cooking something, when they are boiling something. And you want to make sure it cooks through evenly. So you have to mix it up so that everything boiling on the bottom reaches the top, and that everything on the top that wasn't quite boiling is now going to reach the bottom. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is treating the Yam Suf, says Rashi, like some massive boiling pot of food, and he is mixing up the Egyptians in it, boiling them alive. Why is this very significant? Well, the Jewish people cross through the Yam Suf surrounded by fire on every side. And in contradistinction, the Egyptians went into the Yam Suf and they were boiled alive. And if we said that the meat of the Korban Pesach couldn't leave your house because you couldn't leave your house, and you have to eat it quickly because you're going to leave quickly, and you have to eat it with matzah because you're going to leave with matzah, and you have to eat it at night because the Makkah Bechor happens at night, and you have to eat it on Chatzot because the Makkah Bechor is going to have on Chatzot, and you have to and you can't break a bone because be'etzim ayom hazeh, and you can't leave over any of the meat because you're not allowed to stay back. Then what we're seeing is that everything that happened to the Jews on that night become the details of the Korban Pesach. In which case, why is it that it must be Tzli Esh? Why is it that we can only eat this Korban roasted in fire? Because that night, we were roasted in fire. Sorry, not that night exactly, but in Kriyat Yam Suf, when passing through, we were roasted in fire. We were surrounded by fire on all sides, and nothing even separating between us and the fire. That's why it needs to be Tzli Esh, and no pan can come in between. Whereas, who was boiled in water that night? The Egyptians. And that's why you can't eat the Korban Pesach Mevushal B'mayim, because you are not them. They were boiled in water, you were roasted in fire. You must eat the Korban Pesach roasted in fire like you were roasted in fire, and not boiled in water like they were boiled in water. Because if you want to continue the symbolism that the Korban Pesach represents, it needs to be a representation of us and our experience in Yitziat Mitzrayim, so it needs to be surrounded by fire and not boiled in water. That is the Mitzrayim. You can't do anything to the Korban Pesach that was reminiscent of what happened to the Mitzrayim. And we have one last detail that we need to touch upon, which is Rosho al Kirav ve'al Kirbo. Where does that fit in? And if you want to suggest that not only is the symbolism by what you must do to the Korban Pesach reminiscent of what happened to the Jewish people, but what you may not do to the Korban Pesach is reminiscent of what happened to the Egyptians, then what Rashi says here is going to blow your mind. He says as follows, Vayisar et ofen merkavotav, mikoach ha'esh nisrifu ha'gagalim. Right? The koach of the fire burned the wheels of their wagons, v'amerkavot nigrarot v'yashvot be'em na'im. Right? And the wagon started to be, the chariot started to be dragged across. And then what happens? The Evarehen mitparkim. And their limbs began to be dismembered. Right? The limbs of the Egyptians were dismembered in the Yamsuf. So why must you cook your Korban Pesach in one entire piece and not limb by limb and not piecemeal? Because the Egyptians' limbs were dismembered. And so the Korban Pesach, which is a representation of our experience in Yitziat Mitzrayim and not the Egyptian experience, must be in one piece to contrast how they were dismembered. So I think that this comparison is a very strong one. I think the symbolism that exists between what we must do to the Korban Pesach and what we experienced that night is very strong. I think that it is mashma, it can be inferred from the psukim. I think it's mashma, it can be inferred from Rashi. I also think it's mashma from the following Gemara in Brachot, Daf Teremet Aleph. There's a machloket between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah as to how long you have to eat the Korban Pesach. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says you have until Chatzot to eat the Korban Pesach. Rabbi Akiva says you have until the morning to eat the Korban Pesach. Again, we're talking about the details for eating the Korban Pesach that apply for generations. The halachot about the Korban Pesach. How does Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah know that you're only allowed to eat it at Chatzot? Because he makes a gzeira shava. He says, it says by Korban Pesach, Laila hazeh, and it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu went out to execute the Makat Bechorot, Belaila Hazeh. Just like Belaila Hazeh, when referring to Makat Bechorot, is only until Chatzot, so too you can only eat the Korban Pesach until Chatzot. But why are you making an inference, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, from Laila, the word night, which is mentioned by Makat Bechorot, and what should be the halachot for eating the Korban Pesach for future generations? If it said Laila by Makat Bechorot that night, then I know that that is the same Laila that is said, that is intended in eating the Korban Pesach for every future generation. Why? Because the laws of the Korban Pesach are learned from what happened on that night. It is an allegory for what happened on that night. And similarly, Rabbi Akiva says, no, you have all night to eat it. You can eat it in the morning. Why? Because it says that the Jews left b'chipazon. And we have to eat the Korban Pesach b'chipazon. When did the Jews actually leave? They left in the morning. And therefore, if it says by the Korban Pesach that we can eat it b'chipazon, that means we can eat it until the morning. So Rabbi Akiva doesn't argue in principle. He just argues where the gzera shava should be applied. Right? He says that he holds the exact same principle. We need to learn the laws of how you eat Korban Pesach from the events that surrounded Yitziat Mitzrayim. It's unbelievable. It is pshat, I think, in the Psukim, in Rashi, and in this Gemara, that the laws of Korban Pesach are learned from the events that surrounded Klal Yisrael in Yitziat Mitzrayim. But then we have to ask, what's the Yisod here? I mean, why? What is this coming to prove? What is this coming to teach us? I want to bring in two Rambans and then a Rashi that I think really tie this all together nicely. First of all, the Ramban in Parshat Shemot says that Klal Yisrael did not deserve to leave Mitzrayim. We didn't deserve it. We deserve to stay there forever and become assimilated. And yes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised Avraham that he would take the Jews out and give us Eretz Yisrael, but a promise does not need to be kept if what the promise is based on, which is the merit of Klal Yisrael and the commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Klal Yisrael would have, doesn't come through. We abandoned HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Mitzrayim. We were almost no better than the Mitzrayim. In very, very few areas, we held on to our identity. Almost no better than them. And we did not deserve to leave that night. Why did we leave that night? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it explicitly. He says to Moshe, I've heard the Jewish people crying and I've decided to take them out. And says the Ramban, no, you promised Avraham you would take them out. And the time is up. And that's why you're doing this. What do you mean you heard them crying so you take it out? No, you promised Avraham and you're fulfilling your promise. The time is up, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't going to take them out. Why did he end up taking them out? Because he had mercy on us. And that's it. We didn't deserve it. We should have stayed there, lost forever. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu had rachamim, he had mercy on us, so he took us out. The second Ramban that I want to speak about is Ramban in Vayikra, where Ramban introduces what exactly a korban is. What's a korban? The different Bali Machshav have a different approach to what exactly we see the value is in slaughtering an animal when we did something wrong. What does that help us with? And we see clearly in the Nevi'im Achronim, that the fact that we thought we can slaughter animals and exempt ourselves from any real tefillah or tshuva or personal growth, it was detestable in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what are we doing at all? Says the Ramban, it's a symbol. Why are we slaughtering an animal? Because we're coming for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we're saying as follows. God, this should have been me. It should have been me. I deserve to die for what I did. Thank you that in your endless mercy, in your endless rachamim, you're accepting this animal in my place. And that's what a korban is. It is an animal being killed in place of the perpetrator himself. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu had mercy and agreed to take an animal in your place. And now I think we understand the significance of Korban Pesach and its historic implications. What was the Korban Pesach? I think that the Korban Pesach was a reminder that we weren't supposed to leave that night. Because a Korban is in our place. When we deserve to die, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has tremendous rachamim, tremendous mercy on us, he says, I'm not going to take you. I'm going to take an animal in your place. We did not deserve to leave Egypt. We did not deserve to leave Egypt. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had mercy on us, and therefore we left Egypt. And so what did we have to do? We had to bring a korban that was going to be in our place. And how did we remind ourselves that the korban was in our place? Everything that happened to us on that night became the halachot and the intricacies of the dinim of Korban Pesach. So we would never forget that what is this Pesach? What is this korban? It's us. It's us because what's happening to it deserved to happen to us. And we'll never forget that only in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mercy, he spared us that night. And the korban we're bringing in place of ourselves is going to have 12 or 13 different reminders that this is a reflection of what was supposed to happen to us that night. And here's the kicker. Rashi quotes Yeshayahu in understanding what Pesach means. What does Pesach mean? Everyone knows the Passover interpretation. That's actually the second idea that Rashi quotes. He originally quotes the first interpretation from Yeshayahu, which is, what does Pesach mean? Rachamim. What did Kadosh Baruch Hu mean when he says, I'm going to see the blood on the doorposts, and I'm going to pass over the house with the blood? Says Rashi, he's going to see the blood on the doorposts, and he's going to have rachamim on any house that has blood on it. That's what the Korban Pesach was. It was rachamim. It was supposed to be us. Kadosh Baruch Hu took an animal instead. If he saw that we slaughtered an animal, he took the animal instead. He had mercy on us. He took the animal instead. Pesach, to pass over, really means that he had rachamim on any house that did this in its stead. And to remind ourselves of that fact, everything that we experienced at that time in Yitziat Mitzrayim became the details of Korban Pesach, Ledorot.